I'll be an old woman.
Today's April 9th. We're studying Baba Kama. It's our first class after a long break of 3 months. Our last class, back in December, we studied the first Mishnah of the sixth Perek, sixth chapter. And I thought that it's best to go back and review that. I'm not sure if everyone here was there. It's been a long time. If we want to begin this chapter, know what's going on, we have to learn the first Mishnah. Mm-hmm. So we're back in Perek Shishi, Mishnah Aleph. And the Mishnah reads as follows. Hakunes son nadir, v'na'al b'faneya karu'ui, v'yatsa v'zika patur. Translation, he who is collecting the sheep into the sheep pen and locked in front of them properly, v'yatsa v'zika, and went forth, it's the feminine here, referring to tson as a group in the feminine, the sheep went forth and caused damage, exempt, the owner is exempt for paying for the damage they caused. Lo na'al b'faneya k'ru'i, if he didn't lock in their presence properly, in other words, the same situation, he was kones tzon nadir, he was bringing the sheep into the pen, but this time instead of na'al b'faneya k'ru'i, it says lo na'al b'faneya k'ru'i, he didn't lock up in front of them properly, v'yatsa v'zika, and they went forth and caused damage, chayav, if he didn't properly lock the sheep pen, they got out and caused damage, chayav, he's obligated to pay for the damage. Next set of halachot, nifratza v'layla, oh, you're looking for the place?
I'm still disoriented.
Perek Shishi,
okay. I'm used to that big table.
Sorry.
Perek Shishi, no big deal.
You can put me
Shishi,
here if you
Mishnah,
need
Mishnah, I don't want to load you. Mishnah what?
Aleph.
Oh, okay. Found it. Thank you. Sorry.
The second halakha, second clause, nifratza v'layla, o shepartsua listim, v'yatsa v'zika patur. Translation, nifratza v'layla. This means that the pen was shattered or broken down at night. Nifratza.
Nifratza is not from a pritza that somebody has, robbers opened it?
Could be. That's very likely. We'll get to that later. But what it says, nifratza balayla, it was broken down at night.
O shepartsu
alistim, or highway robbers broke it down. So in the first case, it is a passive verb. It doesn't say who broke it down. It just got broken down. In the second case, the listim broke it down. And in both of these cases, v'yatsa v'zika, the sheep went forth and caused damage, patur. Which seems to say, patur, I'm not going to say more than that. We'll go back and talk about it. And then the third clause, hotziu ha-listim, ha-listim chayavim. Brought them forth, the listim brought them forth. In other words, the listim didn't just break down the pen, they actually brought forth the sheep from out of the pen. Then halistim chayavim. Then the listim are obligated to pay for the damage that was caused by the sheep. So again, if the listim broke down the pen and the sheep got out on their own, the listim apparently are not obligated to pay. But if listim did something to take the sheep out of the pen, then the listim have to pay for the damage caused by the sheep.
Yeah, but the listim has to pay for what they robbed. Go and find them.
I agree, but theoretically, if we find them, do they have to pay? Even if we find them, if they didn't take the sheep out of the pen, but just broke the pen down and the sheep got out anyway, apparently they don't have to pay, even if we find them and bring them to trial. That seems to be what it says. We'll have to go back and think more. That's the first reading. Okay, so now let's go back and go word for word and talk about this. I'm going to read the beginning again. Hakunes tzon nadir, v'na'al b'faneya karu'i, v'yatsa v'zika patur. Lo na'al b'faneya karu'i, v'yatsa v'zika chayav. And we'll talk about that for a few minutes.
Can I just ask a grammatical question? How would you, tzon is singular and plural?
Good question. All I know is what I see here, and I see that tzon seems to be feminine, singular.
What's the plural for? I mean,
it's a collective noun.
Okay.
Sheep.
So it's used as, like we use the word sheep.
Like fish.
like fish,
in
right?
English, or sheep, actually. I think yes. also can be singular or plural. Like, yeah. I didn't know that in yeah. the Hebrew. Just
that's what we see.
Mm. Yeah, because Israel is called Tzon Kedoshim.
Hmm.
Ah. Uh-huh. In the plural.
Right.
Yeah. So, the first question I ask in the sheet is the following. What would be the halakhic definition or definitions of the damage done by these animals that escaped? When I say halakhic definition, hint, I'm going back to the first Mishnayot of the Masechet.
Like with Shane and Regel. Right?
Like Shane and Regel.
Yeah.
Shane and Regel as opposed to?
Karen.
Karen, right? So just to remind us, Shane is damage caused by teeth, right? That's what it means. It means they ate produce, they ate things. Shane, that's Shane Regel, of course, is feet trampling, they stepped on things. Just to review, Shane and Regel are damages that we expect the animals to do. Sheep go around and they trample things and they eat things, that's what they do. It's expected, and therefore we say that the sheep are mu'adim, or to say it in the singular, they're mu'ad to do this type of damage. It's expected.
Right.
As opposed to Karen, goring, which refers to unexpected, aggressive, non-normal behavior. That would be Karen. Now, my nafkamina, what does it matter if we classify it as Shane and Regel or we classify it as Karen? Big difference. What's the big difference?
Karen is only liable in case of warning.
Not so.
No?
No. Ah, okay, so you mentioned Rishiyot. Let's talk about Rishiyot. What is the relationship on the one hand between Karen and Shane as opposed... Sorry.
Shane and Regel in Rishiyot Rabim are...
More should I shut my door?
It might be my broke.
Hello. Hi. Welcome.
Hello, Mitchell.
You can join us.
Hi. Everybody, this is Mitchell Brook.
Hi.
You missed a few explanations, but I'm sure you'll catch on.
Just a minute. I'll move there so he can see the Mishnah with me.
Okay.
See you soon.
So you'll be lost for the first 6 or 7 hours, but you'll...
That's all right. I'm part of the lost tribe.
Okay, so let's talk where we were talking. So the question was... Okay, all right, good. So the question was, Shane and Regel on the one hand, as opposed to Karen, and then Ilana brought up the question of Rishuyot, of Rishut HaRabim and Rishut HaYechid.
In Rishut HaRabim, Shane and Regel is more lenient on the animal that does damage, because you shouldn't leave things in Rishut HaRabim. You expect them to be trampled on and eaten, and
right.
so on.
Right. And what does it mean, more lenient? Topless. What right. is the monetary payment? Patur. Right? So let's remember what that means. That means if sheep or any other animals do damage in Rishut HaRabim, in the public domain, damage of a type that is expected, that's the way they behave. That's the way sheep behave in Rishut HaRabim. They trample and they eat. So the halakha is the owner's patur. Right? In Rishut HaRabim, Shane and Regel patur. Where does the Torah obligate Shane and Regel? Rishut HaYechid, which means if my animals escape and they go into your property and there they trample or they eat, then I have to pay. But if they don't go into your property, they disdain Rishut HaRabim and damage your stuff in Rishut HaRabim, I don't have to pay. That's Shane and Regel. As opposed to that, we have Karen, right? So what's the law of Karen in Rishut HaRabim?
Hayav.
Right, Karen has to pay in Rishut HaRabim. Goring, meaning aggressive, unexpected damage caused by my animals in the public domain, does have to pay, but only has to pay how much?
Chetzi.
Right, chetzi nezik. It's considered to be tam as opposed to muad. And it only has to pay nezek shalem, full damages, in Rishut HaRabim if it is muad, if it's been warned. You mentioned warning, right? And as far as Karen in Rishut HaYechid, that's a machloket among the Tanaim. If it has to pay tam chatzi nezek, or if it has to pay actually Nezek Shalem. We don't have to talk about that right now. So now, remembering that, we go to our Mishnah again. So now we're looking at the Mishnah again. Hakunes tzon ledir b'na'al b'fenei karui. He brought his tzon, his sheep, into the sheep pen, and he properly locked it, and they got out and caused damage patur. Whereas, if he didn't properly lock it, and they got and caused damage hayav. So we're saying, when it says they got out and caused damage, it means they got out and caused damage...
Although he locked it properly.
Even if he locked it improperly, right? Lo na'al b'fenei karui. He didn't lock it properly. They got and caused damage in Reshut HaYachid, in the private domain.
So far he's in big trouble.
He's in big trouble.
Yeah.
He has to pay for all the trampling and all the eating that his animals caused in someone else's property. But if they caused that problem in Reshut HaRabim, even though he didn't lock properly, what's the deen? The law? If they cause it in Reshut HaRabim,
Patur,
because it's Reshut HaRabim, and Shem and Regel don't pay in Reshut HaRabim.
So you can let your animals run loose, essentially.
If they're not aggressive.
If they're not aggressive.
And they cause no damage.
Right. Say it again, please.
And they cause no damage, which is...
No, even if they cause damage, right? Even if they cause damage of in the public domain of the normal activities that they do, you don't have to pay, right?
But you told us that the fields were close to each other. So if you let your animals run loose, they would go to a Reshut HaYachid.
Okay, so you, the owner, have to know that you're going to pay if that happens. And also remember, we learned about the fact that there's Reshut HaRabim and then there's Sidei.
Right.
Reshut HaRabim. Mm-hmm. Remember, there's the margins of Reshut HaRabim, like on the sidewalk at the entrance to the stores, that if your animals get there and cause damage, Shane Varegel, you do have to pay. But Sidei Reshut HaRabim, the sidewalks, they're like Reshut HaYachid. So when we say that you could let your animals run loose, it only means in those areas of Reshut HaRabim that are made for
animals
livestock.
So then what's the difference then between Sidei or Reshut HaRabim and Reshut HaYachid?
It's basically the same thing.
So then why shouldn't they, why this halacha construct at all then?
Oh, because from a point of view of ownership, no one owns Sidei or Reshut HaRabim. So it's not technically Reshut HaYachid, it's Reshut HaRabim.
But
it's
what's the practical implication of that difference? There's no practical implication of that difference? In terms of patur v'chayav...
In these terms, it's just like Reshut HaRabim, just like Reshut HaYachid, but for many other areas, like say Hilchot Shabbat, right? Mm-hmm. It's still Reshut HaRabim. For what you're allowed to do there. There's lots of other implications of Reshut HaRabim and Reshut HaYachid other than just animals causing damage.
Right.
Am I allowed to set out my my table there and sell lemonade?
Are you in? Yeah, sure.
In a place that's not mine, it's Reshut HaRabim.
Right, sure. But you are allowed to sit out and.
But if my table gets knocked down,
then you're.
Then it's my problem.
Right, then it's your problem.
Oh, no, take it back. No, I overstep the boundaries of my knowledge. Take it back. I don't know. But in any case, there are other implications.
But there was an issue of doing compost in Sidei Reshut HaRabim.
And I actually...
I forgot what was the
I've forgotten also. Okay, so let's concentrate on the Mishnah. Question two was, in which domain do you think the damage was done? We asked that already. So we're talking about Shein and Regel in Reshut HaYachid. Question number three. Does this Mishnah come to limit or to expand what has been taught earlier in the tractate? Just think about that for a minute, okay?
Now we have to remember.
I mean simple knowledge that we just discussed around this table in the past 5 minutes. Just think about the question and try to answer to yourselves for a moment. Like, don't anyone speak, don't blurt it out. Just think about it. I'm going to think myself to remember. Does anyone want to, What I could do is I could make the question even clearer. I'm going to phrase the question as follows. Does this Mishnah come to limit or to expand damage payments that had been taught earlier in the tractate? Damages that you know have to be paid. Does this Mishnah come to tell you to pay more or to pay less? Can anyone relate to that question? But then let me go deeper. We said we're talking about shein and regel and reshut hayichid, which means my animals got out of the pen, went into your field, and ate and trampled. Until we learn this Mishnah, what would be the halacha in that case? Has to pay, yes or no?
In any case, it's patur. If it's, yichid, in any case, it's chayav.
Chayav, right. We would have thought before reading this Mishnah that if my animals get into your field, trampled and or ate, the halacha, you would say, if I woke you up in the middle of the night and said chayav or patur, you would say chayav. It's in reshut yichid, shein and regel, they're trampling or eating, have to pay. Does this Mishnah come to expand upon that or to limit that?
To limit,
right? Because what is now we begin to understand the significance of this Mishnah. The Mishnah says, even though my animals got out of my pen and went into your property and caused lots of damage, even though that's the case, I am still patur if what?
If you locked properly.
If I locked. Listen to that. That's pretty interesting, right? My animals got into your property, caused lots of damage, and according to all the halachot we know, I'm responsible, and I'm not responsible if I turned the key properly when I went to sleep at night.
Yeah, where's the negligence?
Very good. As long as there was no negligence,
well, that's the principle.
Right? Even though I caused damage, and I'm certainly responsible for the damage, if there was no negligence, I don't have to pay.
No autopsy, no foul.
Are you a lawyer by chance? Any chance?
He's a doctor.
Okay. Oh, the autopsy stuff. Right. Okay. So that brings us to the next question. On what basis might one espouse a position different from the one taken by this Mishnah?
On the basis of the previous laws that we knew.
Yeah, but what would be the ideology behind it?
That part of the listim.
So forget about the listim. I'm just talking about the beginning of the Mishnah.
The basis would be that, irrespective of whether there is negligence or not, they are your animals.
Right.
And your animals caused damage, compensable damage.
Yeah. Right. My animals are on your property and they cause damage. I have to pay.
Whether you locked it or not is not my problem. You have caused damage to my property.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me.
You assume a responsibility by having an animal.
Good. Which brings us to the next question.
And there's another issue.
Mm-hmm.
We learned that if your animals ate food in another place, you're responsible for that amount anyway.
That's right.
But now...
Now suddenly you're not responsible.
Right, this is a limitation of a lot of things we learned earlier.
But why would you be responsible if they ate food from a public domain?
From my private field.
Yeah, because she tended her field. She worked her field. Her labor needs to be compensated.
Right. So let's think about the next question now. What do you think might be the social or economic ideology behind our Mishnah's halachic position? In other words, you could have said, I forgot your name, Uzi?
Mitchell.
Why did I say Uzi? I don't know.
Because I remind you of a gun.
Could be. Oh, that's interesting. So anyway, we could have thought of the possibility that if my animals got into your property and caused damage, I have to pay. That would make a certain degree of sense. The Mishnah says, no, don't have to pay. No negligence, don't have to pay. So what type of society or what type of society assumptions does the Mishnah make? What type of society is it trying to sustain?
It's a society that everybody has animals. And if you'll have to start paying, you will not be able to sustain life.
Yeah, certainly, that's part of it. In other words,
because today it's my animal, tomorrow it's your animal in my field.
So the Mishnah has an ideology in which it wants to encourage, allow and encourage people to make a livelihood. And in those days it means having animals. And no, there's a certain danger in having animals, but it's okay. As long as you did your piece and you locked the deer pen at night, you're okay. And of course, if the legal system wanted to discourage this type of free enterprise, it could have said, no, you always have to pay. And what would be the result?
Nobody will have animals.
Not necessarily.
Or less.
Because there's another question that's begged. How did the animals get out? The animals didn't get out of their own accord if the fence and the posts and the pens in which the sheep found themselves were properly maintained. Something other than an act of God had to happen. And so to presume that the only thing at work here was someone saying, well, I locked the door, well, but did you maintain the fence?
Okay, so let's talk about that.
So whether or not, with due respect to my teacher over here, we have an agrarian society or a society, and the live and let live principle in law, if you will, okay? The issue still is one of personal responsibility for maintaining a proper environment. And the distinguishing between public and private lands is a very interesting one.
Okay, wait, so let's talk about proper maintenance.
Right.
The question is, what is proper?
Well, yeah.
But they say, but what
proper is maintaining a space for the animals such that within a reasonable degree of probability.
Okay, so let me explain what reasonable degree of probability is to the Mishnah.
It's community standard.
It would be a community.
But let me explain what it is. Right? So karaui, properly, what is properly? The halakha defines it in the following sense. A fence that's properly locked is a fence that would stand up in a ruach mitsuya, a normal wind, in other words, normal conditions. So let's look at the following scenario, right? I properly maintain the fence. I properly locked it. What does it mean? It means I built the fence with a lock that stands up under normal conditions. However, sometimes there are abnormal conditions. There is ruach she'ena mitsuya. It doesn't have to be a tornado. Uncommon wind. The fence falls down in uncommon wind.
But if it's properly maintained, why would it fall down from an uncommon wind?
Because properly maintained means it's strong enough to stand up in a normal wind.
This is
right.
You can't make a law for every circumstance. So in order to maintain societal order, you have to have a standard. All right. So for instance, tonight the winds are going to be very high. There's going to be large golf ball size hail. Now if I own a car, do I not have the responsibility to have enough common sense to take it out of the open and put it in a place where it's not exposed? It's my responsibility to do that.
Right.
All right. So if my car gets damaged from hail and someone took a parking space that was a public parking space, that's my tough luck. You can't sue the other person for taking a parking space.
So let's build on that. Of course, it's possible to build a fence that stands up even in a ruach she'ena mitsuya. And the halakha could have said you have to build a fence that could stand up even in those circumstances. But halakha didn't say that. All you have to do is build a fence that stands up under normal circumstances. And that exempts you. You're not negligent. But if a ruach she'ena mitsuya, which might be, I don't know, 30% of the winds or 20% of the winds. If one of those 20% of the winds comes and knocks down the fence and the sheep get out, as long as properly locked, then you, the owner, are not responsible. But I just want to emphasize, the halakha could have required more and it didn't. Right? It didn't require more. It wouldn't have, it could have required more. But that would be too much in the eyes of the halakha, too much to require from people. It would be too much of a sacrifice. The halakha wants to allow people to keep sheep and to keep lots of them. Okay? So, we can go on. The next question is number 6. Where was the very last time that we earlier learned about the concept of kara'ui? Which of course goes back 3 months ago. So we'll have to search in the material.
We have Mishnah Vav.
Mishnah Vav, yes. In the previous chapter. Right. Right. So let's read Mishnah Vav, the sixth Mishnah of the previous chapter, and compare to our Mishnah. We don't have to read the beginning of the Mishnah. We only have to read in the middle of the Mishnah. I'm looking
Kisau
Kara'ui. Do you see that in the Mishnah?
Yeah.
So this is again chapter 5, Mishnah 6. And it's talking about a boar, a pit in Rashut Terabim. And let's talk about the fact that you dug a pit in Rashut Terabim. Kisau Kara'ui, you covered it properly. Kara'ui, the same expression as our Mishnah. V'nafal l'tocho shor o chamor v'meit. And fell into it an ox or a donkey and died. Patur, you're exempt. You, the owner of the pit who dug it, are exempt. Even though, because of your pit, this animal fell in and Rashut Rabim and died, you're exempt. Lo kisau karui, if you didn't cover it karui, you dug it, but you didn't cover it properly. V'nafal l'tocho shor chamor v'meit, and one of these animals fell into it. Chayav, you are obligated. So let's point out that the halakha could have been more stringent.
They could have said, don't dig any pits in Rashut Rabim.
Don't dig at all, and if you did, you're responsible. The only way, the halakha could have said this, but it didn't, the only way that to exempt yourself from responsibility would be to do what to the pit?
Fill it in.
But the halakha doesn't require you to fill it in. Just to cover it, kara'ui. And a covering that's kara'ui stands up in a ruach mitsuya, a normal wind. But an abnormal wind could come and take the cover away. An animal comes and falls into it, and you, the digger of the pit, are exempt. Because you are not negligent, according to the halakha's definition. Although, it's still true, you could have been more diligent, but you weren't. You're not required to be. So it's very similar to our Mishnah. The boar and the case that we have here of the tzon are parallel.
And is it exclusively wind, or can it be rain damage, hail?
Any damage.
So it's environmental, normal environmental.
Right, the halakha talks about the fact that you put there a good cover there, but after 3 years it got wormy, and it lost its ability to hold up animals that are working on it.
Mm.
So again, I don't know the exact definition of how strong it has to be, but the fact is, halakha doesn't require you to fill in the pit, but only to cover it.
I just mean in terms of wind versus rain.
No, really, yeah, anything.
It's
normal rain, normal wind.
Normal metaphor.
Cold
weather.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor.
Yeah.
It's not specific. The object being you have to cover it properly.
Right, first for normal.
Irrespective
general
of
conditions.
What happened. Okay. It's
right.
The idea of what problem
right.
is, which is essentially community standard. I mean,
there's a standard
nothing extreme
of
within a reasonable limit.
And what did you say if it gets worn out? The cover?
If it gets worn out.
Kara'ui?
I don't remember all the details.
But
I just remember that case.
But if it gets worn out, Rabbi, then it wouldn't. If it wears out over a certain period of time, then it would no longer necessarily meet the definition properly.
So I admit I don't remember
but
what proper is as far as worms go.
Well, but
does it have to stand up for 3 years against worms, 5 years? I don't know.
But the issue shouldn't be the years. The issue is it under normal circumstances? You've said, my understanding was you said proper is under normal circumstances.
Yeah, but I'd admit, how to define that, I don't know. Because let's see, normal circumstances are there's no termites in Hawaii.
Room. All right. So
but this year there were termites in Hawaii.
But normal circumstances are geographic. They're not specific for normal in Israel is not normal in New York, which is not. It's when you make a law in a specific region, normal is defined by the mores of that region.
And the climatic conditions of that region. I assume that's the case.
Okay.
I assume that's the case.
Not to be argumentative.
Yeah. And I just want to make it clear, most of the answers here I don't know. Let's go on. Question 7 we talked about already. Was the concept used in that earlier source in a comparable fashion? The answer is absolutely yes. That boar and shein v'regel. In both cases, we're talking about proper precautions. And we go to 8. Where had we even earlier seen the concept of na'al b'faneya kara'ui? Before this Mishnah in chapter 5, let's look earlier, let's try and remember. Perhaps someone actually remembers without having to look. I'm not like that, I have to look.
Where is Jane and her husband? They used to remember these things.
They've decided that they can't join us this trimester, unfortunately.
Oh, here we have.
Where are you?
Mishnah Tet in Perek Dalet.
In Perek Dalet, the fourth chapter.
Na'al b'fanav kara'ui.
Right, the last Mishnah of the fourth chapter talks about a shor. A shor is an ox. And let's begin 3 words before where Ilana read, just to get our bearings. So again, this is the very end of chapter 4.
Right,
very end of chapter 4. Kasharo va'ala b'mosera. Tied it, its owners, with a leash. We're talking about an ox being tied by a leash to a hitching post or something. V'na'al b'faneya kur'ui. That should be read as or, locked in front of it properly. We're talking about an ox here. V'yatsa v'zika. And it went forth and it damaged.
You have it female? We have here male.
Yatsa v'zika, I'm sorry. I don't know why I made that mistake.
It's sexually.
Okay, so this is the same type of case we've had with the boar, the same type of case we've had with the tzon. You did your due diligence, and in any case, the ox, in this case it's an ox, got out and caused damage. The halakha is, echad tam v'echad mu'ad chayav. Echad X and echad Y means whether it's this or that, right? Perhaps you want to look, whether it's this or that, got out and caused damage, chayav. But that is Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's only the opinion of Rabbi Meir.
Rabbi Yehuda
Omer, Tam Chayav Muad Patur.
How come?
As far as the Tam, if the one that's not expected to go out and cause damage, got out and caused damage, that Chayav, of course, for Chatzi Nezek, because that's the law of Karen, we're talking about Karen, Muad Patur. Muad Patur, and it brings a verse. Go into the verse. Let me just explain that the Gemara says that when it says Muad Patur, it means the Muad doesn't have to pay the Nezek Shalem, the full damage money, but it does have to pay what it would pay what it were to be a Tam, which means Chatzi. Patur doesn't mean completely Patur according to the Gemara.
Oh.
It means it's Patur from the extra payment over and above being a Tam, because a Tam would have to pay. So the Muad doesn't have to pay as a Muad, has to pay as a Tam, has to pay 50%. That's the second opinion. The third opinion, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Ein lo shmira ela sakin. There's no guarding for an ox except for the knife.
It's like a pit bull.
Which means, so what's the halacha if it got out? Does it have to pay?
Kaful.
Has to pay, right?
Yes.
If it's a Tam has to pay Chatzi, Muad has to pay full.
Yes.
So the idea of Rabbi Eliezer is that there's no such a thing vis-a-vis oxen as proper guarding except for slaughtering it. If it gets out, you have to suffer the consequences in your wallet. Whereas we said that Rabbi Meir says basically the same thing, that you're always obligated when your ox got out and caused damage.
Yes.
And I don't have to talk now, there's a nuance of difference between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Eliezer. It's not important for our purposes. For our purposes, they both say you have to pay if the ox got out. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda, you don't have to pay for the Muad except just for the Tam.
Hi.
Good evening.
Sorry to interrupt.
But you did make it.
I'm so late. I have your book in the car.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Sorry. In the balcony or something?
Yeah. Well, we do have two seats.
One chair here and one chair.
Just
here.
Have to separate.
Okay.
Is that okay?
So we can move that one.
Okay.
So this is fine. I can sit here. No, this is fine. There's here the tail end.
Yeah, they're separable.
Yes.
Is this only the case in the matter of ox?
He's sharing this.
That's exactly the big question. I hope we'll get to it tonight. If not, we'll do it next week.
And is it a function of size and strength?
No, just. but I want to leave that on the table. So just let me see. Do you guys, you need some sources to look at?
I'll just listen.
Yeah.
Well, you, go forward. Don't.
Here, I have my...
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Just let me show you. We're at the end of chapter 5 for now. Let me just find you the place, and then we will. Chapter 5. The end of chapter 5.
It's page 53 on what I have.
Yes.
53?
For
chapter 6. This is
what
chapter
60.
51.
What page?
We're talking about this. What earlier? 53, yeah.
53? 53, it says here, Baba Kama, chapter 6.
It says chapter 6.
Yeah.
I was trying to find for her the...
talking about...
Okay, so stay here and then you'll catch up. Okay, very good. So anyway... I want to do a little bit of thinking now. And those who just walked in won't be with us. I want to try and compare the Mishnah that we began with about the sheep and the Mishnah now about the ox. So the Mishnah of the sheep, just let's remember, if you lock them up properly, they got out and caused damage, you don't pay. Whereas it says with the oxen, you did the same thing, you locked it properly, but if they got out, according to two of the three opinions, you do have to pay. Right? With the ox, if it got out, it caused damage, according to two of the three opinions, you have to pay. Only according to one of the three, Rabbi Yehuda, you have to pay less. Right?
Foxes are aggressive.
Okay, so then, but let's go slowly. But so the question is going to be, what's the difference? Why is there a difference between the case in chapter 6 and the case back here in chapter 4? Let's try and think what could be the possibilities. What are the variables that we're talking about? So one possibility, of course, is that we're distinguishing between oxen and sheep. That could be, right? What's the other possibility?
Keren and Regel.
Very good. Now, we're not distinguishing between different types of animals, but rather different types of damages. Let's remind ourselves of what we're talking about. In the case of the sheep, we're talking about damage caused by the feet and by the teeth. The animal got out and went into someone else's property, and if it has to pay for damaging with the teeth or with the feet, it's full damage money, shein v'regel. It's damage that's what the animals do. They walk and they eat. On the other hand, the Mishnah at the end of chapter 4 is talking about keren, is talking about aggressive, unexpected, out of the ordinary behavior. In reshut ha-rabim. In reshut ha-rabim. The animal gets out and goes a goring in reshut ha-rabim, so the halacha is that according to most opinions it has to pay. Even though you tied it up properly.
That Mishnah doesn't specify what kind of damage, though. An ox isn't only
you're right. Well,
keren, but I guess within context of the Mishnayot before.
Context is keren. So let's have a minute of silence, or even two, to try and think about what could be the... why would these differences make a difference? Right, that's the question. Why does these differences make a difference? Okay, so let's just think about it. Let's just think about it. Why do differences make a difference? Anyone want to suggest why these differences make a difference?
The nature of the
animal. It's either the nature of the animal or the nature of the difference between keren on the one hand and shein.
Which goes to the animal itself.
Which might be related. Right. Okay, so you want to elaborate upon that? Or?
Sure. I'll try. Let me ask you a question, since we're all Jews here. I can answer your question with a question. Are you allowed to charge more for the use of an ox than you are for a sheep? An ox have more value in a society than a sheep, since your responsibilities and liabilities are greater for an ox.
Want my answer?
Yeah.
You can charge whatever you want.
Okay. Then, irrespective of that, when you take charge of an animal or anything, you must accept a personal responsibility for the nature of that animal. And irrespective of your best efforts, there are certain animals where whatever happens, they're going to cause damages. And the only way to distinguish those damages in a fair and equitable way is to distinguish whether there are damages of the horn or other, other kinds of damages. That's the only thing I can think of. Because if I take... To me, it makes sense if I maintain an ox pen appropriately with the amount of timber that's necessary and under proper circumstances, it doesn't make sense to me that I should be held liable. But this is what the Mishnah says, so I'm held liable. So it would seem to me, working backwards from that construct, that I have to, by virtue of owning that ox, assume that responsibility. So the only way to give me any semblance of fairness, if I do maintain it in a proper way in either of the first two, and even with the knife in the context of the third, is to differentiate between the kinds of damages. And the kinds of damages that an ox does and a sheep does are two different things by virtue of the nature of the animal.
Okay, but you didn't go far enough in defining it.
Let me just
add that the definition, as we've learned, of shein and regel are things that animals normally do. Mm-hmm. The definition of keren is here is something that is unexpected, that is aggressive, that is out of the ordinary. When the Torah tells us that you have to pay for the out of the ordinary behavior of your ox, the Torah is basically telling you, you have to pay for things that you can't guard against, by definition. That's why it's only Hatzi Nezik. Because really, there's nothing you could have done. For Shein and Regil, you know that they normally eat and they normally trample. Therefore, you can look out for such things. But an oxen sometimes just go crazy. And they gore. And it doesn't usually happen. But it sometimes happens. And it happens for no reason. It's out of the ordinary. You really couldn't guard against that. Because it just happens unexpectedly, aggressively. Sometimes the oxen get aggressive. And therefore the principle of Karen is, I believe, that you're held liable. Only half damage. But you're held liable for something you couldn't prevent.
But
the minute we've said that, we understand what's going on. That's why, even if you took normal measures with your oxen, if it got out, you're still responsible for Karen, because that's the definition of Karen. Things you couldn't prevent. And that's why, again, it's only half Nezik and not full Nezik. When it is time, of course.
But in a broader context, you could have prevented it by not acquiring the oxen.
Right, of course.
But then you wouldn't have an agricultural society.
Not necessarily.
A vegan society.
Okay, let's go on. Let's go back.
Interesting that it's so that's a major distinction then from
here. Karen on the one hand.
No, I'm saying like here with you're talking about like with the climate, environmental, weather conditions. You don't have to be prepared for you're not obligated for something out of your control. But sometimes you are, sometimes you're not.
In Shane Verigil, you're not. In Karen, you are. Because that's the very nature of Karen. Things are out of your control.
But it's kind of interesting that you're held liable for something that you can't prevent.
That you, again, you could have prevented it if you didn't buy an ox.
You take the extra risk.
But there's an extra risk which is in Karen.
Which is why I asked you the initial question. If you take that extra risk, and if you assume that liability, by taking that extra risk, would it not be appropriate for you to charge a different price, a higher price? No, it's not necessarily in the same tractate.
What do you mean the higher price?
Well, I mean, for instance, would an ox then have a higher value in society than a sheep? An ox,
or a lower value, because it's more dangerous. You might end up being saddled with a price tag.
Why would I keep it?
Because
then?
He works on it. Because
you need it.
So if I'm taking an ox...
The field.
Right. So should I not be allowed to charge appropriately for the risk that I'm taking? This is what I'm asking.
I know, there's someone... I see.
Whatever people will pay.
But we're dealing with specific... Well,
but just, okay, the halakha allows you to charge whatever you want for your goods.
What are using it for?
Right?
Okay.
Let's go on to the next question. Let's go on to the next question. We answered 9. What's the difference between the scenario in that earlier source and here? And number 10, we answered, how is the tendency of the Lord different than the source? That in the source in chapter 4, the tendency is to require you pay even when you were not negligent. And we answered question 11, why is it different? We talked about that now. And we get to question 12, which brings us to the next section of the Mishnah. Question 12 brings us to the next section of the Mishnah. So let's go back to the beginning of chapter 6 and read the next question, the next section of the Mishnah. And now Vivian and Mary Beth will be able to fully join us because we're going back to the opening Mishnah. I'm going to read the second clause, which begins with the words Nifratza. Nifratza balayla.
Yeah, why balayla?
Okay, wait a second. That's exactly where we're getting to. Nifratza balayla, which means the sheep pen got broken down somehow at night. O shepartzu alistim, or highway robbers broke it down. Viatza vizika, and went forth the sheep and caused damage. Patur. So let's think now. That phrase, I'm claiming, is difficult or superfluous. So I'll go backwards. I said it's difficult or superfluous, and I told you what clause I mean. You tell me why.
Ooh, which one is the...
The one I just read. The one I just read, beginning with Nifritza Balayla, up to the words, or Pratzu Alistim, V'yatzah V'zika Patur. It's difficult to understand what's that doing in the Mishnah, or it's superfluous. Explain to me why it doesn't fit.
Because if it Nifritza... Who cares how it nifritza, if it's listim or not listim? Why do we need to have osha patzua listim?
No, I don't mean that internally this is something superfluous. I mean that clause in relationship to the rest of the Mishnah. The whole clause we just read.
Because we just talked about whether it was kirui or whether it wasn't. And if it was kirui, he's patur. If it wasn't, then he's chayav. And so that... The nifratzu is...
There's no place for it. We know all cases already. We know 100% of the cases. All cases are either I locked the pen properly or I didn't. If I locked it properly, the law is I don't have to pay if the animals got out and caused damage. If I didn't lock it properly, then I do have to pay when I got and caused damage. That covers 100% of the cases. There's no case that's not one or the other. Either I locked it properly or I didn't. So we know the law in 100% of the cases. So what do you have to tell me now? That if it happened at night... The halakha is patur. Well, what do you mean happened at night? Either I locked it properly or I didn't. If I locked it properly, then I don't have to pay. If I didn't lock it properly, I do have to pay. So now you say at night you're patur. In which case is it? Locked it properly or not?
Unless it comes somehow to tell you.
Ah,
even if it's lower,
to modify. It comes to modify, perhaps. So let's go stage by stage. My first reaction is that this clause is superfluous.
What does lora ui mean?
Not properly. Right?
Okay.
So firstly I say, I don't understand this clause, it doesn't fit, it doesn't belong here. But then Jeremy says, perhaps this clause comes to modify the previous clause. So let's think how that works. So the obvious question is going to be, in this case in which, let's talk about Lila, at night. It got broken down at night, the sheep got out and caused damage, patur, the halacha is. Is it a case, I'm going to ask Jeremy, okay? Is it a case in which I locked it properly or I didn't lock it properly?
I did not lock it properly.
Jeremy is right. Because it's telling me, even though the previous clause told me that if I locked it properly... No, did not. Right. If the previous clause said if I did not lock it properly, I am chayav. And this one comes to modify that. Even though usually... not locking it properly is a reason for you to be chayav. But if it happened at night, even though you didn't lock it properly, since it's at night, you're patur. So if that's what you mean, Jeremy, the question is, why are you patur? Let Jeremy answer.
Because you couldn't have reasonably seen that it was Nifratsu somewhere at night.
Makes sense, right? That makes sense. It could be that Jeremy is right. Now, I'm not saying that that's the only way of reading it, and I'm not saying it's comfortable. I still think the Mishnah is creaky. But
why is it in there, though?
I don't know.
Make the distinction?
I don't know. That's the question. So, but if it's already there, Jeremy says, perhaps we could fit it in. So Jeremy is saying the Tosfot. Let's read the Tosfot, okay? The comment of the French rabbis in the 12th, 13th centuries.
The grandchildren of Rashi.
The grandchildren of Rashi. So we're going to read the Tosfot here. It's near the bottom of the page.
I'm kidding.
Where it says, Tosfot Mesechet Baba Kama Daf Nun Heyamud Bet. Yes, Tosfot, right, 4. Tosfot Baba Kama, page 55b. You know what? Perhaps I'll put Jeremy on the spot. You want to be back in Yeshiva? You want to read the Tosfot?
Yeah, which one? Daf Nun Hey Amud Bet?
That's it. Does everyone see the first the place? I'm just asking. Yes. Okay.
Okay. Nifratza Belaila, that's right.
Yes.
Nifratza Belaila, Afal Pi De Tana Nal Bifneak Ru'ui Patur Itztarich Lematne Nifratza Belaila Patur Kedadik בפרק כמה דף יודלת הביום חייב דקלה איטלי למילתה ומסתמה ידע שנפרצה.
Let's stop there. Okay. Let's stop there.
What is this?
Let's read very slowly, right? So נפרצה בלילה, and Jeremy read אף על פי דתנה quote נעל בפניה כראוי פטור end quote. Translation, even though Tana, we learned in the Mishnah, quote, Na'al b'faneya karui patur, you're exempt if you lock properly, it's tarich l'mitne, it's necessary to teach us, mitne for language of Tana, of teach, it's necessary to teach us, quote, Nifratza b'layla patur, that if it got broken down at night, you're patur, Kidadaik beperakama, as we make a textual point in the first chapter of Baba Kama, we're not going to read that, which comes to teach us, Ha beyom chayav, behold in the daytime, obligated, culpable, dekala itle.
Kala.
Kala, do you know what kala is?
Kakal. Kakal.
Which means? No, kol. Even though call? There's a voice, that's even though the word gets out.
Batko.
Oh,
yes.
Dikala itle, that a voice, yeshlo. Itle means yeshlo, there is to it. A voice means people know if it happened in the daytime, everyone sees. Ha beyom chayav dikala itle lemilta. There's a voice there is to the matter, to the milta, to the matter. Umistama. Yada shenifritza umistama, and we can assume that he knows that it got broken down. So this is very complicated. I will explain. It's the exact same type of logic that Jeremy used. It's just the opposite. Very close, just the opposite. But it's the same type of logic. So what does the Tosfot say? He says, even though we learned in the Mishnah that you're patur if you locked it properly, this Mishnah has to tell us that if it happened in the daytime, you're chayav, because you should know what happened, and you should go and round up your sheep. So Tosfot claims that this clause is coming to modify the first clause, but whereas Jeremy said we can understand it's coming to modify it to be lenient, Tosfot says it's coming to modify it to be
circumstantial.
To be strict. To be strict, right? Even though you locked it properly, you could still be obligated if it happened in the daytime. I locked it properly. But it's daytime. I saw that my sheep are running around town. What are you going to tell me? That because you elected properly, you're exempt from collecting them? No, you have to go collect them. If they cause damage, when you can prevent it, you're obligated. Says Tosfot. So Tosfot is saying that the Mishnah, this clause of the Mishnah, comes to add a stringency. Hmm. Does it make sense?
No, because it happened at night.
No, it says if it happened in the daytime. Oh, I see. Right, I forgot to explain that point. Thank you so much for the question. Thank you so much. Of course. Tosfot is being very subtle here. He's saying that the Mishnah is coming to teach what it doesn't say. Let me explain. Thank you, Mary Beth. When the Mishnah says that if they got loose at night, you're exempt, it means to imply if they got loose in the daytime, you're obligated.
Right.
And after it says you're obligated, that comes to modify what the first clause says, you're patur. You're patur when, if you locked it properly, this comes to tell us, even though you locked it properly, if it happened in the daytime, even though it says nighttime, but it means the opposite of what it says, if it happened in the daytime, you're obligated because you could have gone and rounded up the sheep.
A reasonable chance of rounding up the sheep.
You said there is a reasonable chance.
Yes, if there is a reasonable
if there
chance,
is. Yeah.
Which is incumbent upon you to prevent damages, and you could have, then irrespective of whether you locked it or not, you're still responsible. But at night,
says Tosfot,
you can't see it. How can you be responsible?
Right.
And plus, you're unconscious at night.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, what Tosfot is saying is certainly not written in the Mishnah. Because he's actually saying it means what it doesn't say. It talks about nighttime, and it means you should learn daytime. It says nighttime is exempt. You should understand that means that daytime is obligated, and it means obligated even though the first part of the Mishnah said not obligated. You locked it, you're not obligated, but if it happened in the daytime, you're obligated. You are obligated.
So why would they do it backward? Why the subtlety? As opposed to, why not just come straight out and say...
To me, the answer to your question is 100% clear. In the following sense, clearly Tosfot is involved in an effort to make sense of a Mishnah that doesn't make sense. It's a reconstruction. It's what we call a terutz. It's a, how do you say terutz? It's a reconciliation, an excuse. And clearly the Mishnah doesn't say what he says it says. But it doesn't make sense with the words it says. We have to make some sense of it. If you have a historical, critical mindset, you'll say, wait a second, what Tosfot is saying, okay, I can fit into the words, but is that really what the Mishnah meant? And I want to go back and say, wait a second, is there any other way that I can understand it that will make more sense? It must have meant something else. It can't have meant what he says it meant, because it would have said it differently if that's what it meant. So, do we have time now?
Yeah. It's easily put in the following manner. The problem is always how you state the problem.
Yeah.
So?
Well, the point is that if you construct something in the negative, right, you want to make a point. You can construct it in the positive, but it can add to the confusion. But by sometimes constructing something in the negative, it serves as a contrast.
Okay,
and
right.
And by that contrast, you can then see the point. Hence the expression, the problem is always how you state the problem.
Okay, so if you wanted to go in that direction, you would have to show that stating things in the positive would have caused more confusion. And sometimes the Talmud does go in that direction. In this case, though, I don't know that line of logic.
We don't know.
So... what we'll do is we'll take the last 10 minutes of the class, even though we did only a quarter of what I wanted to cover. We'll continue next week, I guess. And that's fine, right? That's fine.
Sure.
Professor Hanoch Albeck, who is the editor of the Mishnah set, he has a historical, critical mindset, and he knows that what Tosfot said is really the only available answer in the traditional literature that is commonly studied, but he's not satisfied. So he has a suggestion.
Can I ask one thing before you get it? Does this,
is there a principle here that like all the rules that are not otherwise specified only apply for daytime? Can you infer something like that? That, you know, like if everybody knew that, of course, you know, it's obvious that this first part was referring to the daytime because when else would it be referring to? Then it would make sense to...
There's no such principle.
But there's not a principle.
What Tosfot says here is totally ad hoc. It's an effort to understand...
For this, so this case, it's not generalizable.
No,
from this
not case. Generalizable, not at all, not at all.
Only in this case.
So, Professor Chanoch Albeck brings a little learned source, the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
He brought it before, or you brought it before?
Could be. Let me say a word about this. So, Tanitic, we have, of course, Tanaitic literature. Literature from the time of the Mishnah that has reached us. There are midrashei halacha, midrashim on subjects of halacha written by the Tanaim that have come down to us in books. On the book of Exodus, we have the Mechilta. The Mechilta is the Tanaitic halachic midrash on the book of Exodus. The Mechilta, and it's called the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. The Mechilta from the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yishmael. Now, that's the only Mechilta that we know of. But there are certain Rishonim, certain medieval authorities, who mention and quote a different Mechilta, an additional Midrash of Halakha, written by the Tanaim on the book of Exodus. This is apparently a midrash that existed once in writing in the Tanaitic period, in later periods up to the Middle Ages, but we lost it. We don't have that book. It wasn't learned enough by Jews, wasn't copied by scribes, and we don't have a copy today. Rav Professor David Zvi Hoffman, a German rabbi at the end of the 19th century, tried to recreate this lost Mechilta. And what he did is he took quotes from other books written in the Middle Ages by the Rishonim, that say, I'm quoting the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And he brought all these quotes together and reconstructed a Mechilta. In some cases, he had to work on guesswork. Some rabbis in the Middle Ages said, here's a midrash on the book of Exodus that I'm quoting. It's not in the Mechilta of Rabbi Yishmael that we know. It's not anyplace else. So Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman seemed it must be from this lost Mechilta, and he put it into this collection. And then lo and behold, in the Cairo Geniza was discovered a copy, a frayed copy, a partial copy of this Mechilta. So that was put together with the reconstruction work that Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman did. It was done by Professor Ezra Tzion Melamed, going back 40 years ago. And they put together and published the reconstructed on the basis of Geniza fragments, on the basis of the work of Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the Mechilta de Rabbi Yishmael. So the work exists today. You can buy it, but you have to know there's a lot of guesswork, right? What's written there might not be all of what was in the original work, and some of what's written there might not really have been in the original work. It's guesswork, but it's scholarly guesswork.
Yeah, but I mean, what a piece of scholarship.
Oh yeah, it's exciting.
And frankly, if you think about oral history and as it's transmitted, we really don't know if it's actually what happened, because things get lost in translation.
Things get lost all the time.
Right.
So again, but that's just an introduction, right, to let's take our time now to learn this piece of Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Yeah. So at the very bottom of the page, at least in my printing it came out here, just the headline, Mechilta Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and the content is actually in the next page.
What is Mechilta?
Mechilta simply means a tractate.
Oh, okay.
But the Mechilta de Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is the second Tanaitic Midrash on the book of Exodus. And here's something quoted by Professor Albeck, who says that this piece can help us understand our Mishnah. Okay? Here we go. Mikan ata omer, from here you say, Haganavim shepatchu et hadir ufatchu et ha-mukzeh. V'yatsa beima v'yizika. I will translate. From here you say that the thieves that opened the sheep pen and opened the muktzeh. Now, the word muktzeh doesn't fit in this context, so the editor, who I said is Ezra Tzvi Melamed, suggests perhaps it's a mistake and it means michitza, who opened the gate. So you have these thieves that opened the gate and yatsa beima vizika and went forth the animals and caused damage. Haganavim pitorim. The thieves are patur, they're exempt. Uvalabait patur, and the owner is also exempt. And it brings a proof. We don't have to read the proof.
Let's go
to the end. After the period, last five words of the line, four words. Hutsiua ganavim, if the thieves actually took the sheep out, they didn't just open up the door, they actually took the sheep out, and the sheep went out and caused damage. Haganavim chayavim, ubalabait patur. The thieves are obligated to pay the damage, and the owner is exempt. So, wait, don't say anything. Just wait. Hold your horses. So, Ezra Tzvi, Hanoch Albeck looks at this Michilta, and he says it's very similar to our Mishnah. It is very similar. But he notices two differences. He notices that here there's no mention of Laila, no mention of nighttime. And secondly, he notices that there's mention of thieves as opposed to highway robbers. And our Mishnah says listim, and here it says thieves.
What is the difference?
A highway robber does things kind with a high hand.
You mean with power?
With power.
Yeah, with them.
A thief comes at night, usually.
Wait
a second. So Professor Aldeck says to himself the following. There's no mention of Lila here. And on the other hand, there's no mention of Listim, highway robbers. There's only mention of Ganavim. I wonder if thinking of that can help me go back and read our Mishnah. So he comes to the following reading. Go back to our Mishnah. And again, this reading is just suggested by the Mechilta. It's not written in the Mechilta. So he looks at the following. And he says, perhaps we're reading Nifritza B'Laila, right? Mm-hmm. We thought let me just tell you what he says. He says, Nifritza B'Laila, that probably means thieves. Ganavim.
Come by night.
Nifritza B'Laila means thieves. Thieves opened up the sheep pen. It says Laila. Who does things at Laila? That's thieves. And then when it says, O shepartsua listim, that means, or highway robbers, when do they do their stuff? In the daytime. They just come with a high end and they just do whatever has to be done. Yetsa vizika went forth and caused damage patur. Who is patur?
Bala bait. Bala kvasim.
No, that's the point.
The criminals.
So in other words,
to do with...
Right, it's nothing to do with the balabait. That's the whole point. Mm. Don't try to see how this clause fits with the previous clause. It's no connection. The previous clause was telling you balabait, the owner. And the owner, what matters is locked it or didn't lock it. This clause has nothing to do with the balabait. Just like this clause says, partsua listim, the listim opened it up, patur, who's patur? The listim.
And the ganavim also?
The listim. And when it says, nifratza b'layla, it got opened up at night, patur, it doesn't mean the balabait is patur. It means the ganavim are paturim. So the conclusion is, whether thieves came and opened up your sheep pen at night, or whether listim came and opened up your sheep pen in the daytime, as long as the thieves or the highway robbers didn't actually take the sheep out, all they did is broke down the fence and the sheep got out on their own, Hizika patur. The thieves and the listim patur, we're not talking about balabait.
Then why, in the next sentence, does it have to say, halistim chayavim?
Right. And Jeremy says, wait a second, let's look at the next clause that says, hotsihu alistim. If the listim actually took it out, then the listim are chayav. And Jeremy asks, well, where are the ganavim there? Mm-hmm. And for that, Professor Albeck has to say that it's implied, but it doesn't say. What it means is whether the thieves took out the sheep or the least team took out the sheep, as long as the thieves or the least team did the activity of actually taking the sheep out, not just letting them out, but taking them out, then the thieves or the Ganavim are Hayavim. And why doesn't actually say the word Ganavim? Well, the truth is it never said the word Ganavim in the whole Mishnah. We're just assuming that once it said Lailer, we assume that we're talking about Ganavim. Thieves.
It's actually a different question.
Oh, I'm sorry?
It's okay, it's okay. Because if you think that we're transferring the word Patur to the Ganavim and the Listim, why does it not say Listim Patur and then Chayavim? Why does it wait to say Halistim Chayavim in the last sentence? In other words, if you're talking about... Nowhere does it say earlier Habalabait Chayav, Habalabait Patur, Habalabait this, and then you see what I'm saying? You understand what I'm saying?
Good question. But that's really not a question on this interpretation. It's in general a question on why is the word listim
well,
written there twice?
It's a question on this interpretation, because you'd think that if they're trying to if one transfers the word Patur over, that if they were going to use Halistim, they would have said Halistim Patur.
I got you.
So it is a question on that interpretation, I think. Or it's a question on transferring the word Patur to the Listim.
Okay, you know what?
In before.
Whatever it's a question on, I don't have an answer.
Okay.
How about this? Supposing if you go with this whole idea of the Ganavim and the Listim, so in the first case, everybody's behaving in their normal course of stealing. So the Ganavim are coming at night, and the Listim come in the daytime, and the sheep get out. Mm-hmm. And so maybe here, the new feature of the second sentence is that the Listim are doing something unusual, because maybe they wouldn't ordinarily be cattle or rustlers. But Ganavim would steal them, so you'd expect that. You see what I mean? So,
well, I don't know. Listim are coming in for some reason.
Right, but so do they normally steal cattle versus somebody who steals cattle, you know, or steals?
Oh, right, I read it.
Because then I could see that would be
their purpose. No, the purpose of Ganavim and Listim is to steal cattle.
They will steal cattle. So Listim, I thought, rob you, not necessarily take your property. Or, well,
they said they come with a high hand in the daytime. But what did they come to do? They came to take the cattle. Right? They didn't succeed for some reason.
Okay, so that's their... Okay.
What happened is they went to the pen. They broke it down. They took hold of the cattle to steal them. But then they got frightened off. And they left the cattle outside where they had put them.
Mm-hmm.
So then they're chayav because they literally took them out of the pen.
So this is... They would normally be
stealing
your cattle.
I think so.
Well, I have a question. If I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that if either the highway robbers or the thieves broke into the cattle pen and left, but did not take the cattle out, they're not liable.
Right. Does that bother you?
Yeah, it does.
I understand.
Because
we're finished. Okay.
Now, if you're going to say, since the Mishnah doesn't say that the sheep or cattle left the pen, then they're not liable, I understand. But if the sheep and cattle left the pen, they will have left the pen as a proximate cause of the actions being taken by the thieves.
Right.
So I don't understand how they cannot be held liable in the context of what was discussed before, irrespective of whether they are a listim or a ganavim.
Right.
It makes no sense.
So let's end with that question, and it's a good question.
Different from all that.
But the answer is in the question. The proximate cause. In halacha, it's called grama. Causation.
Oh, we had
the listim didn't. Aren't directly responsible, they're only indirectly responsible. They broke down the wall, but the sheep got out on their own. Now I know you're going to say that, wait a second, then why is the matter of not locking properly or not, what does that matter? Yeah. It matters because there we're talking about the owners.
Oh, but you're talking about the action, the owner. But
the least team are not owners.
But they're still their action, though, Rabbi. It's still their action of knocking down the fence. What do you expect a sheep to say? Ah, wait a minute. I love it here. I'm not going anywhere.
I hear.
I want to go across the street.
So I just want to tell you that not only is Mitchell bothered by that, the Rambam is bothered by that. And we'll get to the Rambam next week.
Okay. So next week we'll have the Rambam.
Okay. So it looks like next week we're going to continue with the same sheets. I think it looks like there's enough material here.
Okay.
To
unless you decide you want it.
If you decide you want to stay with us,
yeah,
then it's $85 for the trimester.
Oh, okay. Then I'll just write you.
Yeah, you don't have to.
That's fine.
Okay.
Are you kidding?
Great talking to you, Josh.
She's been after me.
Yes, I am in the guest.
I mean, at 9:30 at night, I'm done to my best thinking.
Thank you.
Okay. No, I'm coming.
Is this event also?
I'm here in
the
guest area.
Oh, is that
where Mavis is? Oh, thank you.
I understand.
I managed to lose everything I come with.
To know.
Thank you.
Can
I adopt you?
So if you remember next time to remind me the way I ended this week.